Welcome to the EcoNews Report, your weekly environmental news show. I'm your host this week, Jen Kalt of Humboldt Baykeeper. And like always, I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Tom Wheeler of Environmental Protection Information Center.
Hey, Jen.
Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Hi, Jen.
And Scott Greeson of the Friends of the Eel River.
Hey, John.
And our guest today is Troy Nicolini, meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Eureka, Woodley Island. Welcome to the EcoNews Report.
Thanks.
So you're based there at Woodley Island. People generally, I think, know the National Weather Service is a very critical federal agency that alerts the public not just of rain, wind, and drought and, you know, daily weather patterns, but also catastrophic events like hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, tsunamis, things like that. So, Troy, you have been a local leader in developing our tsunami warning system, as well as tsunami evacuation plans, educating people about sneaker waves, all kinds of amazing things that's really critical for saving people's lives and keeping them safe along the ocean. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that developed over, you know, say the last decade or so?
Yeah, sure. And I've been, you know, up here on the North Coast for 20 years now. And I think when I joined, the National Weather Service forecast the weather and kind of considered that for the most part to be the end of our job, like let you know about the weather that's coming or a tsunami that might be coming. But through a series of events for me personally, as well as agency-wide, we started to learn that people need to know what to do when they get that information, or they often make the wrong decision. In fact, you know, sometimes that's the biggest problem, it turns out now, is the human factor. We've gotten pretty good at hurricane tracks and timing and even tsunami travel time and arrival time here on the West Coast. We can nail it down to within 10%. But if folks don't know what to do when they get that information, we find that they often get in trouble. So there's been a really big emphasis in my own personal work for many years to try and work with communities and individuals, whether it's tsunamis or small hail on the road or sneaker waves, as you mentioned, to do a lot of education and preparedness work with community members.
My recollection is that when there was that huge tsunami in Indonesia the day after Christmas.
2004.
Oh, yeah. At that time, people said, well, geez, great thing we have a tsunami alert system. And I thought, really? What is it? And what was it at that time?
Well, that's an interesting question. And in some ways, that was the wrong observation for folks to make from that event. Because just go back. And by the way, that's when I took over the program, right in 2004. And the previous 10 years had nothing, just for the record. We had 2004, 2006, 2009, 2010, 2011. My tsunami career has been really busy, just by the luck of the draw. But when you go back to 1964, the earthquake that happened in the Aleutian Islands that traveled down and hit Crescent City, you know, with significant impacts, most folks got notified, even back in 64. In fact, half the deaths happened because people went back too soon. They actually heard about the event, but they thought it was over prematurely. So fast forward to 2004, most of the deaths that happened were not because there wasn't a warning system in Indonesia or around the entire Indian Ocean. They happened because people didn't know that the warning system was the earthquake. So had they just known to go to high ground if they felt an earthquake, many people who died would have lived. So relate that to our coast, and when you ask the question, what is our warning system, what's the status of our warning system, it's a big, complicated, technical monster, much like the stuff on the table right now to make this recording happen. You know, sometimes things work and sometimes they don't. And so it's true that you should always be questioning the warning system to alert people of a tsunami when the earthquake happens really far away. And we work on that constantly, but we test it here every year. I feel like we have the most solid warning system in the nation in this region. But honestly, that's almost of secondary importance. The most important thing is that folks know if they feel an earthquake, they go to high ground. See, look at, there I go. I'm using your show to get that message out. I can't help it, but that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure folks are not under a misunderstanding about what the earthquake means when it happens here on the North Coast.
So once again, if you feel the ground shaking, if you feel significant earth movement, how long an earthquake means you should run?
Great question. We used to actually have people count, but I conducted some very informal social science studies, and I can tell you, even with a group of people who know better, if you ask them during the last earthquake, how many people knew they were supposed to count, all the hands go up. How many people remember to count? Half the hands come down. So we've switched from that counting notion to a simpler one, which is that if you're in doubt, drill it out. So we came up with a slogan. So basically, if it's a really short little earthquake, like some people in the room feel it and some don't, that's probably not going to cause a big, huge tsunami. But if it lasts for 5 minutes, there will be no doubt in your mind that that is an extraordinary earthquake, because I've never felt a 5-minute earthquake. A 20-second earthquake feels really long. So 5 minutes, perfectly clear. Half a second, you barely feel it, perfectly clear, no threat. Anything in between, there's no downside to going ahead and evacuating to your high ground as a drill, really. It's more complicated if you're shutting down a nuclear power plant or things like that. But for the average person, there's really no downside to just going ahead and treating it like a serious event and practicing your evacuation. So thanks for that question. That's a really good one.
Well, and the signs that have gone up all around the Humboldt Bay area alerting people where the tsunami zones are have been really helpful and gotten people to think, you know, okay, I go through maybe two or three tsunami zones before I get to my kid's daycare center, which is in a tsunami zone. So what am I going to do if there's an earthquake? And if it's a very close by earthquake on the Triple Junction, what, you have 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes to figure out what to do.
Exactly. And that specific scenario, we're asking about a parent who has a child in a school. As a parent of a 7-year-old, the safety of your child takes precedence over everything, even your next breath. It's really important that parents know that there's only two schools in Humboldt County in the tsunami zone, and those schools have incredibly robust emergency response plans, evacuation drills. The one in Manila, they drill every month to their evacuation site. I mean, those kids are ready. The teachers, staff, they all do it. It's amazing. So the parent's job is to make sure that that child who's going to survive the tsunami has a living parent afterwards. And if they drive 90 miles an hour through the tsunami zone to rescue a child who's not in danger, there's a very good chance that that child's going to be parentless after the event because of that decision, which I totally understand. But it's really important that parents find out if you have any doubt about the safety of your child, whether their school's in the tsunami zone or not, and whether they have a good plan or not, contact the school or contact me, and I'll square you away on that so that you can make sure that you have your child is safe, but that you're also living after the event so they have a parent to come home to.
Jacoby Creek also has a really good evacuation.
They do, and they're just outside the zone, but they still have a really great plan just to go ahead and make sure that they're completely safe and they go up the street.
So is the other school where my granddaughter goes, South Bay?
South Bay is the other school in the zone, yeah. Yep. Yeah. No. But they're actually right on the edge, and they have tremendous access to high ground, no barriers, really a great safe environment. Worked very closely with that school. And Jacoby Creek is just, they're on a terrace just outside the zone, and I misspoke. They don't have to leave their campus. Their campus is actually safe. You know, they drill what to do with an earthquake, and then their response is well-honed and well-practiced.
On last week's show, we talked about environmental grief, and we were talking about a subject that's been in the news quite a bit about how people are actually experiencing psychological effects of this sort of constant onslaught of dwindling and endangered species and the climate impacts.
And mercury attaching to plastic in the ocean is like the thing I just read. It's like terrifying.
I know. A lot of these things are absolutely terrifying.
Know, yeah.
So this made me think of you, Troy, because what you do is you talk to people about potential catastrophes that instill a lot of fear in people, you know, just talking about a child being stuck in a daycare place that you can't get to or a school is absolutely frightening. And so we talked a little bit about how do we motivate people, and is it with fear? Does fear motivate people generally, or does fear really kind of make people turn away and shut down and say, well, I'm probably never going to have to deal with that, so I'm just not going to think about it, or I can't do anything about it. That's the real problem, right, is hopelessness.
Hopelessness, yes.
I've heard you talk quite a bit about fear and how to motivate people to prepare. And your earthquake preparation on an older or middle-aged home that was on KINS recently was a really good example, because instead of people thinking like, well, I don't have earthquake insurance, I don't even know what to do, you broke it down into some really simple steps. And you could just give us an example so that message gets out to another audience here on the HNews report. What would you do if your home is on a post and pier foundation? What do you do?
I'm glad you heard that segment. We have a lot of old homes in this region, and we also happen to be the most seismically active area in the lower 48. So we're the Triple Junction, three faults off the coast here. But there's a lot of homes that have been around for a long time and haven't had problems, but many have been shifting off their foundations with every small earthquake. And in 1992 in Ferndale, a lot of homes fell off their foundations. So if you have a really old home on Post and Pier, there's some things you can do to retrofit it to make it more likely to survive an earthquake. And as I mentioned, the California Building Code actually sort of has some provisions to make it easier to do that without hiring an engineer or a geotechnical specialist. And so the cost can kind of be a little bit reduced because of that. There's also grants that FEMA make available for, it's called a Bolt and Brace program. So there's a lot you can do, even for a really old house. Some of the things, frankly, can be really expensive, but there's also some lesser measures that you can do that will still help a lot. And then a lot of the homes that are middle-aged, like in the 50s and 60s, they have foundations, but they're not bolted to the foundation. So you can bolt them down to the foundation. Pretty easy fix that can make a really big difference. So
Is there a website you can direct people to?
If you just search on Bolt and Brace Program, you'll find lots of information about what you can do and how to assess your house. And so it can be very worrisome to think about your house falling off its foundation, but there's some simple things you can do, which I think epitomizes my philosophy on this topic because, well, from the environmental impact standpoint, I'm sort of with everybody else, you know, climate change and sea level rise, as far as being afraid of those things. But in the work I do with tsunamis and other hazards, you know, when I took over in 2004, there was a lot of imagery on TV of the Indian Ocean tsunami, very terrifying images. But I went to a school, but the school said, we don't want to talk about tsunami. We had a tsunami person come give a talk one time, and the administration, the staff, the faculty, and the parents all vowed to never say the word tsunami again because they were terrified. And I thought, wow, that's not really a good outcome. That wasn't the desired outcome. But it's natural to try to scare people into taking a threat seriously. It's an absolutely natural place to go. But I believe it backfires. And so I did some research, and what I found is the evidence that really supports not using fear, we see it every day on our TV screen or in print paper, which is the marketing industry. In general, they've learned that fear doesn't work. And I often show examples, pictures, to illustrate this. When you see a shampoo commercial, typically, you know, it's not a picture of really horrific-looking hair with a threatening message, use our shampoo or you'll have this horrific-looking hair, with the exception of dandruff. But in general, they don't do that because they know that when the person walks down the aisle and they see that brand of shampoo, the image that will pop in their mind is of that horrific hair, so they won't buy the shampoo. They've learned that it's way more effective to show incredible flowing hair with a message, hey, if you use our shampoo, your hair will look like this. And so that's what marketers learn. And so when you look at, for example, for tsunami, you could give a presentation and show a really bunch of terrifying images. You could even lower the light and play appropriate music. I actually saw that in the coast of Oregon. I saw a little elderly person next to me crying, literally had a tear running down her cheek. She was so terrified, hoping that somehow that's going to make people take it seriously. But I believe that they walk out of that with a brochure, they put it on their coffee table, and the next day when they see that brochure, it brings back that horrible feeling, that yucky feeling they had in their gut, and they essentially cover the brochure up with a newspaper. They don't want to bring that bad feeling back. In contrast, so what we've done in this region, and many people may have seen this, is we do positive, uplifting community experiences that make people feel empowered, get to have some hope, and as an added bonus, they now know what to do. So the first big evacuation drill we did in 2007 in Samoa, and it was amazing because that was 3 years after the Indian Ocean tsunami, and people had been sleepless and freaked out ever since that event. We had this drill, and I had people come to me and say, like, I finally feel reassured, like, I know what to do. Like, what more can we do? Right? So by giving them a positive experience, they feel like they have hope, they feel reassured, and everybody wants to feel reasonably good. You can just feel like crap for so long, right? You just can't endure that daily for your whole life. So that really convinced me that you know, you can't downplay the hazard, but if you can put a positive, hopeful spin on it, you can get people to be more engaged and stay with it.
So this makes sense to me for something like tsunami preparedness, earthquake preparedness, but those that have discrete solutions, you know, move to higher ground, bolt and brace, whatever.
Simpler solutions,
yeah. Right? Yeah. For something like climate change, though, I can't imagine the alternative picture. What is kind of the sexy hair flip that we could do for climate change to get people to take this seriously and to start doing?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have a solid answer, but I will share some observations. I've noticed it seems like people are riding bikes and walking less in Arcata than they did when I first moved to this region. And in fact, I was working with a class from HSU studying sea level rise in Fairhaven, where I live, and we met on HSU campus. You know, they had read some really bleak stuff about what climate change and sea level rise was going to mean to us in the long-term horizon. And part of my message was like, wow, but if we just accept that that's going to happen and don't stop it from happening, sea level rise is going to be the least of our concern, you know, frankly. So I'm just curious, of the 12 students in this classroom, who got here to this classroom today without using a car? Try to guess how many students got to that classroom without using a car. Zero.
And oh.
So you want a beautiful flowing hair image. How about someone riding a bike in the advertisement? I mean, really, I know it's frustrating to think that all the small contributions won't make a huge difference, but man, we're not even doing the small contributions. And so it's not that maybe we can't stop the bus from going over the cliff, but people are actually actively with their foot out pushing on the bus to go over the cliff. And I think there's partly an element of hopelessness. I suffer from it a little myself when it comes to climate change. Like, I just bought a house in Arcata, even though I work in Eureka, and that's a daily commute if I move to Arcata that increases my carbon footprint. Like, it's like part of me is just like, what's the point anyway? You know, there's an element, I think, in a lot of our decision-making like that we're not really going off and doing what we can. So hope will make people do more than the lack of hope, I think.
This is the EcoNews Report, and we're talking with Troy Nicolini of the National Weather Service.
The thing is that in our culture, cars sort of represent freedom to a lot of people. And, you know, as a teenager, my bike represented freedom to me because I couldn't get my license till I was 18. My parents were dictators about that. So, yeah, my bike was how I got everywhere. And the thought of being able to live somewhere where I could ride my bike to work, that just would make me so happy. But I can't afford to buy a house in Arcata. Right. I never have been able to afford even to rent in Arcata. And so I live in McKinleyville. I can ride my bike on the Hammond Trail all the way to Clam Beach, and I can walk to the beach and the river and all that. But to ride a bike to work would be a major time commitment. And so how do we make our communities places where more people can do that? I think that's a big question.
Well, you could come to Arcata as a housing forum on September 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. They're asking community input about what does the future of housing look like in Arcata. I think you've hit on a really important topic. Before coming here, I've been here 20 years. I was in Davis for 10 years, and I saw Davis go the opposite way, where sprawl sort of took over and the whole idea of a progressive planning approach to the city and building up instead of out went away. And so I think Arcata has got some really critical crossroads to face in how they address their housing shortage.
So September 23rd, it's going to be at the community center near Hellsport, right? So that's great.
6 to 8 p.m. It's a Monday. That shows the complexity of the decisions we have as a society. How you design a town impacts, you know, how people get to work and to school. It's huge.
Troy, not every threat is susceptible to this kind of hopeful message. For example, there's not really much you can say about sneaker waves.
I was hoping you wouldn't ask about sneaker waves.
But you guys have done a tremendous job with changing the way you talk about these events in a way that really helps people deal with a threat that is both ordinary and extraordinary at the same time. It happens all the time, but people aren't really aware of it. And I think you've really done some great work on that front.
Well, thanks. And that one is a really tricky one. This line of work, in some ways, is really frustrating because we never know about the lives that we save. But I carry the deaths with me, and I will forever. And the 8-year-old girl who died on Big Lagoon Beach is a really troubling one for me because we had not gone with a full-blown fear message. And maybe I was overly influenced by this philosophy I shared with you. But, you know, our approach that I appreciate you complimenting was more of one based on environmental literacy. Make sure people understand the ocean so they can be more intelligent and make better decisions in the moment. The old way, it would have been, stay the hell away from the water. It's dangerous and it's going to kill you. That failed on two fronts for me. One is that when people walked to the ocean and actually looked calm, well, their eyes told them it was safe. The sign said it was dangerous. They believed their eyes. The problem, of course, is that sneaker waves often come in sets, a period of 5, 10, even 20 minutes of calm waves followed by a set of really big waves. So that old approach was just telling them it was dangerous. They didn't believe it. They got too close to the water and got in trouble. Our new approach is to educate people about the set behavior and just don't let the ocean fool you. It can look calm for a long time before a large wave comes. So we feel like we were empowering people to be wiser users of our beach environments up here. But I think certain beaches are so dangerous, Big Lagoon being one of them, that we ultimately decided that collectively as a community that the scare approach for that beach was needed. And the current signs are terrifying. That troubles me a little bit still to this day because now we're asking what other beaches should have that sign. Well, if you carry it to the extreme and put them on all beaches in Humboldt County, eventually you'll get pushback from the community and from the business community like, hey, you're scaring people away from this place that we love. Now they're playing video games instead of going to the beach, and so they're not a very good voter at this point to protect the beach because they don't go to the beach because they're terrified of it. You know, even reflecting back, I often ponder Oreck was an amazing riverside town in the 50s. It got hammered by two floods, 55 and 64. And humans came back with a vengeance and levied the river away from its overbank and its backwaters and basically destroyed that river's ability to produce the amazing salmon runs it had produced since the beginning of time. I wrestle with that fear use. I do think for Big Lagoon's appropriate, but it's a slippery slope. You, four especially, probably don't want to scare everybody from going out there and enjoying the environment because you want them to appreciate and protect it, right? NOAA is an environmental literacy organization, and pure fear that pushes people away from using our natural resources, we have to be careful how we use that, and Big Lagoon is appropriate.
Well, I think you've done a good job speaking from somebody who lost a neighbor back in the early 80s who was on his Harley out on the peninsula.
Wow.
And got swept right off the...
off the jetty?
Yeah.
What a way to go, though, huh?
It was... well, for him, that was probably the way to go. But still, it was shocking to all the rest of us. And it seems so random at the time.
Right.
You've helped, I think, kind of a lot of people wrap their heads around this concept of these sort of random events that are happening by giving them a name, first of all, sneaker waves. Yeah. That's good. And that people understand that these can happen even when the ocean looks calm.
Yeah. Well, you've brought this conversation full circle, because we got most of the West Coast zeroed in on sneaker waves. They used to be randomly called by the media and even agencies either sleepers or rogues. Sleepers implies something that's docile, so we want to push away from that one. Rogue implies something freakishly rare. I'll be honest with you, a meteorite could strike us right now, right in this studio, and kill us all and everything we love and care about. We don't usually worry about it.
We've got a meteorologist.
That's where the word meteorology comes from, by the way. It studies meteors falling from the sky. Snowflakes, raindrops, in case you're ever wondering. But I think when it was perceived as this just unpredictable freak of nature that you can't have any understanding about, people just ignored it. Right? By changing it and saying, no, actually, if you understand how these happen, you can keep safe by watching the ocean and looking for the set behavior and being informed. And I mean, that's really similar to the idea if climate change or environmental issues we have facing us are just so overwhelming and completely out of control, but if you could unravel them and make folks understand their underlying issues and what their contributions can make to those, I think you have more of a hope than just making it seem like the rogue wave that you can't predict. So you just ride your Harley on the jetty because you figure if it's my time, it's my time. And I don't think anybody wants that to be applied to the environmental crisis that this society faces. It's our time.
There's another piece of this that jumps out for me is when you're talking about the 8-year-old. It really feels like one of the core principles here is if we take care of the most vulnerable among us, whether it's the kid on the beach or the little old lady on the Oregon shore who's worried about her house and the tsunami, we really can accomplish a more humane and more sustainable society. That, you know, if we're thinking about the rugged individualist on his Harley out on the peninsula, there's not a whole lot you can do about that guy. And maybe you don't need to. But there are a lot of people who do need our collective help and concern. That's what you're focusing
on. Well said.
On.
I feel like you should come join our Water Safety Coalition. Because, you know, we recognize one of the decisions we made years ago is that we really can't reach a brown water kayaker who's going to run, you know, the eel at flood stage. I mean, the thrill-seeking, adrenaline-seeking, typically young male, whereas the family that comes from Reading to the Trinity River or to our beach and has no idea that's dangerous, and the kid runs down to the water's edge and is taken from them, like, wow, we really need to do something about that. So that's where we put our effort.
Well, and that brings up for me a misconception that I had until I talked to you about it, which is that oftentimes the people who do get swept away aren't from here. Yeah.
50-50. Yeah, it's amazing. We get a lot of locals. I feel like a beneficiary of some of the work I've done for my own personal life, because I grew up on the ocean. I feel like I'm pretty savvy about the water. I interviewed a young woman whose partner died on Dry Lagoon in 2011. And she was not a local, technically speaking, because she was from Reading. But every summer for her entire life, she had come to that same beach with her family. She was a surfer, a scuba diver, a skin diver. And from everything she said, my sense was that she was very savvy around the water. And what I learned from that is that I, too, could get caught by a sneaker wave, because they were trying to decide whether to go around a headland at Dry Lagoon had been encroached upon by the rising tide. And she was watching the ocean and trying to decide what to do, just turned away for a second, and the surge hit her and her partner and pulled them out. I could be that person. It made me realize that I'm way more vulnerable than I thought I was just because I had some knowledge. And so one of the other things I think I learned from her description is that it presented no warning and no noise. I've tried to physically explain that by my understanding of waves, and it kind of makes sense that if it's the first big wave of a set coming on the back of smaller waves, there would be no outrushing water to cause the wave to jack up and present itself. So it really could be a tremendous sneaky wave that comes up with no face and no noise and suddenly shoots up on the beach much farther than previous waves. See, I'm getting in the scary realm. Something to keep in mind if you're a local, that, you know, if you're used to watching the ocean and you think you've got a pretty good handle on it, that these waves can really trick even a local savvy water person.
So what advice for people do you have? What about before it happens?
It's tough. We are now trying to develop skill in predicting the conditions that cause sneaker waves, but it's a brand new field and really nobody in the world is studying this. Many research organizations have studied rogue waves, which really are a phenomenon in the open ocean, and they really are statistically rare, but they impact ships. I wouldn't say reliably, go to our forecast and you'll know if there's a day where there's going to be set behavior. So it really is key that a person can be aware and alert. And so the advice I give is to take a page from the surfer's playbook. And if you've ever driven like the North Spit or anywhere on the coast, and you see a cluster of surfers standing up on a bluff looking at the ocean, and if you hang out for a while, you'll see they're there for a long time. And you could conclude, wow, surfers are really social. They like to hang out and chat, which might be true. But they're actually watching for that set behavior.
They're just chilling, bro.
They're just chilling, bro. If they show up and it looks flat, they know that the set is not happening at that moment. They need to wait long enough to see what the sets look like so that when they go down and paddle into the surf, they can go to the spot where the waves are breaking. Another clue is if you see surfers paddling around the surfboards out in the ocean, but there's no waves, if the waves are breaking near the beach and they're way beyond the waves, then you might think, boy, there's five surfers out there, but they don't seem to know what they're doing because the waves are closer to shore. They're waiting for this set that will break farther offshore. So when you think about surfers, the obvious solution is watch the ocean for a while before you bring your kids down to the water. It's tough, though. 20 minutes takes forever. But if you're deliberate about it and you're getting set up and you're farther back from the water, way beyond the wet sand line, and you're watching the ocean for a while, and then you want to have your kids go get closer to the water, and you've watched it for 20 or 30 minutes and you've seen no sets, that's about as much as you can do in the moment to make sure that there isn't really strong set behavior. So that's my basic advice. And then if you don't need to be near the water, it's always better to be farther from this water. This water is cold, rip currents everywhere almost all the time, and the set behavior is a phenomenon that is just really hard to predict. So in general, you know, if you don't need to be near the water, I recommend staying farther back.
Just a last bit of advice. If you do get swept into the water, what do you do?
Our main goal is to keep people from being swept in the water. There's been very few survivals once someone gets pulled into the surf around here fully clothed. The woman I spoke to was one. It's one data point. I can't say that it is going to work for everybody, but her dad had always taught her to not try to stand up if the water's pushing you out. And so she basically dug her hands in the sand and presented a low profile to the outrushing water, because that was what kept pulling her partner farther and farther out. She would try to stand up and the water would push her back. And she looked over her shoulder and saw her partner being pulled out as she was trying to hold onto the sand. And I can't say it's going to save anybody, but it is something to keep in mind, that the wave is trying to push you out. And if you can resist that, then you have a chance.
I have a friend who got swept off the North Jetty when she first moved here. Wow. She was with three other people and she got swept off. I don't know if anyone else did, but no one died.
Wow.
But yeah, maybe just luck. She just got deposited onto the beach.
No kidding.
Yeah, but I guess what I was thinking is the idea of swimming parallel to the shore to try and get back in, instead of trying to get back in the place that you are getting pulled out by a riptide.
That's a really interesting question. So in the Gulf region of the U.S. and the East Coast, all the posters everywhere show that the rip current goes out into the ocean as a plume, and that if you get caught in one, you want to swim parallel to the beach to get out of the rip current, and you can swim back to the beach. Early off, based on talking to swift water rescue specialists in this region, we abandoned the idea of telling people you can survive a rip current in this region. Our rip currents don't go out beautifully into a plume. They turn right and then left, and they are chaotic and incredibly treacherous. So instead of suggesting that you can survive a rip current by knowing what to do in a rip current around here, our message is don't get pulled into the surf, because pretty much no one gets out of our rip currents.
Is that true in Southern California?
Yeah, in places where the water is not freezing cold and you have time, and the rip currents are pretty well behaved. Nationwide, interestingly, only very recently, they found that that message is not really saving lives, that folks, even in the Gulf and the East Coast, often the rip currents are too complex for them to just swim parallel to the beach. So they're actually rethinking that messaging. But it's true. In Southern California and very warm areas where the waves aren't as big, and in particular the water is not that cold, you don't really have time around here in the cold water to let the current pull you out and swim parallel and get back to the beach, because you start to lose the ability to swim within minutes in this water temperature. And that's the great danger that we have that's unique, is the water temperature.
Growing up in Southern California and spending my youth battling the currents, for fun, you know, I can tell you that that works there.
Yeah.
But you can spend all day in the water there in a swimsuit. Around here, especially with the current pulling against your clothes and the temperatures, you're not going to last.
With shoes on and a little bit of panic thrown in there.
Well, and that brings up a point that, you know, maybe is a topic for another show, which is it's really important to educate the youth, because they educate the adults who think we already know everything. You know, if you're around kids, you know that what you are supposed to do in an earthquake now is not stand in a doorway like I was taught, but you get under a table and hold on to the table leg so there's something over you in case something falls, right? But as adults, we think we know everything, so we do things like start the diesel truck and run it for a half hour because that's what Grandpa taught us.
Wait, you're not supposed to do that?
Yeah, you know, okay.
Some of us still have older vehicles.
If you have a truck that's as old as your grandpa, you may need to idle it for a half an hour, in which case maybe you ought to get a new truck.
So, Troy, I've noticed that the way the National Weather Service reports the local weather it's always in all caps. Why are you yelling at us?
We're working on that, actually. You know, it's a technology thing, not a decision to yell at anybody.
But does it go back to some teletype way convention
back.
Or something?
Yeah, way back. Okay. Yes, we are working through our products and trying to remove capitals and everything we do. Wait, let me rephrase that. I don't know what to tell you. We like to yell.
Sorry. These things are urgent. It's a tornado. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for being with us today, Troy. It was really interesting. Thanks for listening to the Econews Report. If there's a topic you want discussed in a future show, you can email Tom Wheeler at tom@wildcalifornia.org. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Catch us again next week at this time and channel for more Econews Report.